Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with author and media critic Robert McChesney and discuss the real winners in the election so far, and that is the media monopolies, who will rake in a record $5 billion from TV advertising in 2012, up from $2.8 billion in 2008. Robert McChesney has an article in The Nation, After Citizens United, The Attack of the Super PACs. Then we'll examine the serious First Amendment questions that Mitt Romney's official position in the hierarchy of the Mormon religion raise with Francis Boyle, a professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law, who previously taught at Harvard's Law School, where he was a classmate of Mitt Romney's. We will discuss the functional equivalent to the Mormon Pope and his College of Cardinals sitting in their Salt Lake Vatican City, giving orders to an archbishop, President Mitt Romney. Then finally, historian Michael Kazin joins us. He has an article at The New Republic, The End of the Christian Right. As Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum make last-minute appeals to Christian conservative voters in South Carolina, we will discuss the apparent inability of the power brokers on the religious right to unite behind a candidate who could beat Mitt Romney. And joining us now is Robert McChesney, who is the Gutskill Endowed Professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He has written several books on media and politics and hosts the weekly radio talk show Media Matters, along with John Nichols. He co-founded the media reform organization Free Press. And the book Robert McChesney and John McNichols co-authored, The Death and Life of American Journalism, The Media Revolution That Will Begin the World Again, is now out in paperback and in a revised edition. And his latest book is Will the Last Reporter Turn Out the Lights? The Collapse of Journalism and What Can Be Done to Fix It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert McChesney.
My pleasure, Ian.
And you have a piece in The Nation, After Citizens United, The Attack of the Super PACs. And clearly, the super PACs are playing a very pivotal role in this latest election. And I suppose there's a small irony is that the Republican candidates are the ones that are both profiting from it and suffering from it. But at the end of the day, as you point out, the real winners in this are the media.
Absolutely. Well, the point we wanted to make in our piece is that there's a lot of attention that's given to the huge amount of money that's coming into campaigns, and we write about that. And that this money comes overwhelmingly from the top 100, the 1% of the population. Extremely rich people provide the vast majority of this money. So there's no real incentive for average people to give money to campaigns anymore. And all the corruption that attends this. The part of the picture we wanted to add, though, is that if we had a functional news media in society, the power of these ads and the power of this money would be much less. And in fact, what we've seen is that all this money, for the most part, ends up in the pockets of a handful of companies that own the major cable and television channels that get all these ads, and then these are the same channels that people rely upon for news. And the news coverage of campaigns is, in most cases, non-existent in our broadcast and cable news media. And when it does exist, which is largely the presidential race, it's so empty as to be virtually worthless.
Well, specifically, according to your article in The Nation, After Citizens United, The Attack of the Super PACs, Robert McChesney, so far, Needham & Company, the industry's analysts, say that televisions will reap as much as $5 billion, up from $2.8 billion in 2008. That's an extraordinary disincentive, if you will, to fix our broken system, isn't it?
Yeah, the point we make is that the commercial broadcasting industry, which is represented in Washington ably by the National Association of Broadcasters, has no incentive to fix the system. This is, political advertising, post-Citizens United, this is a windfall of profits for local TV stations, which, although I use the word local because they're based locally, are almost overwhelmingly owned by a handful of huge companies that own, scores of these stations. And they're making gonzo profits. The average local television station in the United States 20 or 25 years ago might have made 1% of its total revenues from TV advertising, political advertising. By 10 years ago, it was up in the 5% to 8% range, maybe 10% at the outside. For most local TV stations, depending on the state they're in, they're going to be up in the 15 to 20, 25% range of all revenues in 2012 will come from political advertising. And there are some stations that are projecting 35, 40% of their revenues from political advertising. Political advertising is to local television broadcasting what Christmas is to retail.
And is it such that I assume, Robert McChesney, that the demand is so great because Romney has unlimited deep pockets, and the super PACs that he has, of course, has equally deep pockets, and the others are sort of desperate to get their message out. Has it reached a point, or did it reach a point in Iowa and New Hampshire where there was more money chasing airtime?
Yes, we've been at that point actually even before 2011 and 2012. There used to be a prohibition, or an informal prohibition, on local stations not to run two political ads next to each other to sort of give them some space between commercial ads. And then there was a prohibition on running competing ads next to each other so there'd be some space between two opponents. But those sort of prohibitions all have been blown out the window because all the time is being sold to politicians, or so much of it. And it's created sort of a logjam in the sense that, like, when Rick Santorum had a successful outcome in Iowa, then he rushes to New Hampshire and he's getting money donated to him. He went to buy time on the New Hampshire stations and the Boston stations that serve southern New Hampshire, and there was hardly any time available. I mean, it simply was bought up. He's not able to get into the game.
And presumably somebody that's got a well-oiled machine like Romney had already bought it up, right?
Yeah, probably. That's the likely choice.
So what's the picture down in South Carolina then? Since this seems to be, there's the element of desperation here, a last-ditch effort to stop the Romney juggernaut, if you will. Is that, have the stations been maxed out? I mean, I imagine in the free market, as it's called, that because of supply and demand, if everybody's clamoring to throw money at you, can you jack up your prices?
Well, one time, and I don't think Citizens United affected this, Congress actually put limits on what political ads could be charged, they could charge for them back in the 1990s. So there was, they weren't allowed to be just continually jacked up. Professed concern was politicians didn't want race to price out candidates with less money. The real concern was they just didn't have to pay more than they have to. And I don't think that's really an unfair regulation in any way you slice it. These companies, these broadcasters are making a fortune selling political ads, and they're theoretically using the public airwaves, so which they get at no charge in exchange for serving the public interest. And the primary way they could serve the public interest would be by airing extensive candidate debates, by covering all the campaigns, by drawing citizens of the community into the elections and as participants. They do none of that. Virtually none of that. They just dropped it like a hot potato. All they do is cash checks to run asinine ads. There is a special corner of hell for the commercial broadcasting industry when the final reckoning comes.
One of the things, though, that your article out now in at The Nation, Robert McChesney, after Citizens United, the attack of the super PACs, points out, and it is truly disturbing, is the role of Sheldon Adelson in coming to the rescue of Newt Gingrich in South Carolina. He put up a $5 million donation, which of course is small change for somebody that Forbes listed as the eighth wealthiest American with a $21 billion fortune. He's a big player, by the way, in the Israeli media with a newspaper and television akin to Fox News. And his closeness to Gingrich comes, I think, in part because they share an anti-Palestinian point of view. Gingrich recently referred to the Palestinians as a invented people, which I'm sure was music to Sheldon Adelson's ear. But the point here is, that obviously with the Buckley v. Vallejo decision that preceded Citizens United, where money equals speech was decided, and then Citizens United decided that unlimited money was okay, this raises the specter, surely, that theoretically, I mean, you could write a movie, couldn't you, Bob, that a billionaire bought an American election?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we've already seen this year that because super PAC money is unlimited, and because the rules are written in such a way, and this isn't mandated by Citizens United, but it's the way the rules are written, that you can mask who's giving this money. So Sheldon Adelson came out, but it didn't have to. If they wanted to keep it secret, they could have found ways to keep it unknown. That, we have a very small number of people putting up most of this money, and we'll never know the identity, or probably never know the identity of most of them, like all of Karl Rove's main contributors. And it definitely means that, you know, you can go in and take someone out. This advertising, especially in the absence of journalism, and in a large state where it's impossible to do retail politics, this advertising can be very effective, especially negative ads, which is what super PACs specialize in, tearing down a candidate. They can get someone very unenthusiastic about a candidate. And one of the consequences of negative advertising, which is what super PACs largely do, is that it doesn't, in turning people off to the candidate they don't want you to vote for, it doesn't necessarily mean that you vote for the candidate they favor. It just might mean you don't vote. So this whole process has a tremendous demoralizing and depoliticizing effect. Because rationally, lots of people are going to say, this is a joke. All these candidates are horrible. I see these ads. They're all being paid for by anonymous billionaires. There's no one talking about anything I care about. It's all manipulation. I'm tuning out. And I think in the long run, the people who are paying for these ads don't mind that at all. The fewer people that vote, the better.
Well, just to follow on there, Robert McChesney, the notion that a billionaire could buy a U.S. election, Adelson, as I say, that was small change for him, the $5 million that he threw Gingrich's way to try and save him in South Carolina. The system is such, though, isn't it, that you could actually, a billionaire through a super PAC could put up unlimited money to blanket the nation and presumably also pay for everything else that's involved in a campaign. What role does the Federal Election Commission have in regulating the potential for a billionaire buying an American election?
Well, the key distinction here is why super PACs exist is technically and legally, they super PACs cannot work directly with the campaign. That's the one restriction. And so all the Shelton Adelson money doesn't go to Gingrich, and Gingrich technically can't control it. It goes to a super PAC, which theoretically and legally is independent of his campaign and run by people not connected to his campaign. But as everyone knows, that's a complete joke. All of these super PACs are run by former campaign managers. I mean, they've worked very closely with the campaigns. You know, Colbert and Stewart have been having a whole lot of fun with this on their show for the last week, ridiculing and lampooning this idiocy that everyone knows is nonsense. So a billionaire couldn't give the money directly to a candidate, but they can give the billion all the money they want directly to the super PAC as much as they want. And probably if they play their cards, I keep their identity largely unknown, if not entirely unknown. And you're right. There's nothing stopping someone from going out and saying, I'm going to take my money with a few of my crony friends, and we're just going to destroy all the opposition to the guy, the person we like, to make it so this person is just despised all over the country. And, you know, and that they can be very effective that way. Negative ads do work, especially in the complete absence of journalism, which is the state of America.
So given that the network monopolies make all the money or most of the money, and this year, is the $5 billion estimate for what's going to happen for the whole year, or is that up to now?
No, that's $5 billion is what's expected for what's called the election cycle, which started in 2011 but will finish in November of this year.
Right.
And I might add that our research, John Nichols and I have been doing a lot of research on this because this is actually part of a book that will come out right after the election. We think that $5 billion figure is a very conservative guess when you put everything together. To give some sense, we're going to have a recall election in Wisconsin for Governor Walker this spring at some point. And Governor Walker's already out there with the Koch brothers and the CEO of AIG, you know, raising money from billionaires. And we're looking at probably $100 million just on a governor's recall election. I mean, these figures are simply, these are amazing numbers. This is like trying to talk about the distance between Earth and the distant galaxy. We're in a whole different zone now that we can be throwing out $100 million for a governor's race. You know, that was sort of the entire campaign would have cost that, you know, 50 years ago for all races.
So the networks, though, and they mostly own these stations in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina that money's been pouring at, they're going to reap in at least $5 billion this year, up from $2.8 billion in 2008. But there's also, I think, given what's happening now with Gingrich in his last-ditch effort to stop Romney, ABC is running tonight a very damaging interview with Gingrich and his former wife, Marianne, who apparently says that he proposed an open marriage, which certainly will not go down well with the Christian conservative voters in South Carolina. And this is ahead, of course, of the critical debate tonight on CNN. What's your sense of the role that not only are the media monopolies the beneficiaries of our broken political system, and they've gotten a huge infusion clearly with the with Citizens United and this phenomenon of the super PACs, they also seem to be playing a fairly overt role in picking and choosing winners.
Well, certainly that seems to be the way. Part of the problem is that in Fox News, we have a station that explicitly sees its job as sort of shepherding the conservative voice and finding the correct Republican nominee. And it assumes that role. And that, so all the candidates have to run in what's called the Fox primary to be successful to some extent.
Well, a lot of them are actually Fox employees, aren't they? Gingrich was, wasn't he?
Fox has employed numerous of them in one capacity or another as advisors, consultants, on-air personalities. Yeah, they have close relations with all of them. I know, but I want to get back to the point, which is that the actual amount of journalism being done is preposterously low. I mean, what passes for journalism now on broadcast news is occasionally what remains of print journalism will sprinkle a story over, like the story I think that's coming over on Mitt Romney's bank, you know, taxes and stuff in the Cayman Islands. It's just sort of an interesting story. Now ABC or USAID or some network's got an interview with the second wife about Newt Gingrich's sort of ideas of what a marriage ought to look like, at least before he married his current wife.
And while he was having an affair with his current wife, that was the point. You know, and by the way, this is at a time when he was impeaching Clinton.
You know, and I understand. I'm not here to carry water for Newt Gingrich or any other politician. But what I would say is that if we had credible broadcast journalism in this country, all the journalists, if there were any left, would be out combing the countryside to see who's giving this money, why are they giving it, what are they getting for it, how does this affect our governance? And they would also be getting to the bottom of this, exposing this, and trying to raise issues that are not being talked about at all, as far as I can tell, in the Republican primary. They're of interest to the American voters, not just sort of the goon squad people who attend their primaries.
Well, do we know, or does anybody have a clue of who is behind Romney's super PAC?
Well, yeah. From what we do know so far, it's a very small number of Bain Capital types and hedge fund types and extremely rich types, who the same people who gave these campaigns. Now, instead of just writing, you know, $5,000 checks for the primary in general for his campaign or $2,500 checks, they can cut $1 million checks or $2 million checks to the super fund. It's exactly the same people.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert McChesney, who is the Gutskill Endowed Professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He's the author of Will the Last Reporter Turn Out the Lights, The Collapse of Journalism, and What Can Be Done to Fix It? And he has an article at The Nation, After Citizens United, The Attack of the Super PACs. How does this translate then, because we've talked almost exclusively about the presidential race. And by the way, is the $5 billion figure, is that for all political advertising or just in the presidential race?
All political advertising.
Okay, so let's turn a little then to how this is going to affect the House and Senate. Because I understand that there's quite a number of open Democratic seats in the Senate. The Republicans at least theoretically have a very, very good chance of taking over the Senate. I presume that super PACs will be formed in that regard, will they not?
They will, and there's also things like Crossroads, Karl Rove's super PAC, which, you know, doesn't just support one candidate, but which collects enormous amounts of money from billionaires and then selects races where it's going to operate and devote the money. So, it does, you know, that's a huge player in this, too. What happens with the congressional races and gubernatorial races and other races below the presidency is that the research shows that advertising is much more important because there's very little countervailing information people get because, you know, most of these other races are barely covered, if at all, in the news media, and the coverage they tend to get is so inane as to make the sort of junk that goes on in presidential races look profound by comparison. So money, as a matter of fact, almost always works more effectively in the Senate, House, and gubernatorial races than it does in the presidential race. So there is countervailing material, more of it. And we saw the first evidence of this in 2010, Ian, when Karl Rove and the Republican super PACs targeted 53 House seats they called swing seats in 2010, and they put a ton of money in their super PACs in those 53 races. And these were considered swing races, up for grabs. And they spent more in all 53 by at least $1 million. It's on average, $1 million more than the Democrats spent in those 53 districts, in each of them. And the Republicans won 51 of them. And that sent a really strong message. If you spend enough money, you can win.
Well, just in closing, Robert McChesney, at one of the debates in South Carolina, actually the last debate in South Carolina, most of these Republican candidates, particularly Romney, decried the super PACs. You know, it sort of reminded me of that old line in Casablanca. There's gambling going on in this establishment. I mean, it's a bit like the piano player in the whorehouse suddenly deciding that, finding out that that there's some sexual activity going on. You know, it rang very hollow to me. Their indignation. But what do you think will, in fact, be the fallout from this obscenity that has resulted from Citizens United, which is, I think, pretty clear to everybody? They people were not happy about money in politics before this happened, and I think it's turned into such a disgraceful display of oligarchical power that it's got to at least create some kind of backlash.
Well, on the Republican side, their solution to the problem of super PACs is simply to get rid of the restriction that says that super PACs cannot work with campaigns. And basically that means Sheldon Adelson could give his money directly to the Newt campaign without restriction. So they just want to get rid of that minimal remaining restriction. It seems to be their main concern. And then, in fairness, by doing that, they also then want to have it be transparent so you'd know who's giving the money. But they wouldn't do anything that would cut the spigot of money off. They could all go to the campaign and transparent. That's their reform. I think that is absurd, too. I mean, I think we've seen that that's not good enough. Just because we know Sheldon Adelson puts up the money or Mitt Romney's cronies put up the money, it doesn't stop the effect of being, you know, marinated in these asinine, destructive, negative ads. So I think that the real concern is we've got to get the money out of campaigns. We've got to have publicly financed campaigns. We have to really rethink our whole election process because it's bordering, if it isn't past the border, of absurd. And the place that's going to start, it's going to start this weekend, a series of demonstrations around the country protesting the two-year anniversary of Citizens United. It's going to start with movements like the Occupy movement. It's not going to start with the politicians. It's going to start with protests out in the streets, people making it clear, and then it's going to have to percolate up to the politicians. There are some politicians who are very sympathetic and who will want to do the right thing, but for every one of them, there are many more who got in through this system, who know how to work this system. That's why they successfully win elections, and they're scared to death to mess with the system.
And the Disclose Act that followed Citizens United, the Republicans basically buried it in the Senate, and it was never voted on. Will that ever come back?
It might, and we'll see. We'll see how serious the Republicans are about having disclosure in the next session of Congress. I wouldn't hold my breath or bet on it personally, but I'm always willing to be surprised. Disclosure and knowing who's giving the money is a nice place to start. And as long as someone can give billions of dollars, it's just no way to run an election. It's simply not a tenable solution.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Robert McChesney.
My pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert McChesney, who is the Gutskill Endowed Professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He's written several books on media and politics and hosts the weekly talk show Media Matters, and along with John Nichols, co-founded the media reform organization Free Press. Robert McChesney and John Nichols co-authored The Death and Life of American Journalism, The Media Revolution That Will Begin the World Again, which is out now in paperback. And his latest book is Will the Last Reporter Turn Out the Lights? The Collapse of Journalism and What Can Be Done to Fix It. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the role of Mormonism in this coming election.
All that dying in dust, blowing up your hopes. Flamboyant obstacles, oh, deals made to cope, ideas in decline, rise of the lost, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, here we stand. Slave to networks, master plans. Swags the brand, open a can. Chains off still, yeah, I never ran. But do you think you are? And I hear the master's voice. They run to do their chores at master's calling. Their job tonight, rewrite the Bible for a whole new generation of non-believers.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Francis Boyle, a professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law, previously taught at Harvard University and West Point, and was a member of the board of Amnesty International USA, and worked for the United States State Department in the Bureau of Politico-Military Affairs. Welcome to Background Briefing, Francis Boyle.
Well, thank you very much for having me on again, Ian, and my best to your listening audience. So technically, I did not work for the State Department, but I was there, yes.
But you're also the author of Tackling America's Toughest Questions. And one of the toughest questions, curiously enough, in polite society in this country, one can't talk about politics or religion. And now it would seem that religion is a factor in this current race for the Republican nomination for president. At least as a subtext, we've seen how the religious right are unhappy with the front runner, Romney, who's a Mormon, and they've tried to come up with somebody. And obviously they had Perry and he fizzled, and now they've thrown their weight behind Santorum. So much of the way that Romney's Mormonism is being portrayed is essentially that the bigotry is coming from Southern Baptists who are against Mormonism. But there's been no analysis of Romney's role in the Mormon church.
Well, I think that's correct. From what I've read of Mormonism, it's about as believable as any other religion, so I have no problem with that. But my main concern is a First Amendment issue, which is Romney was and perhaps still is a bishop and a stakeholder, which is the equivalent of an archbishop in the Mormon Church. And the question then is, as a bishop and an archbishop in the Mormon Church, certainly when he was bishop and archbishop, he took orders from the Mormon prophet there in Salt Lake City and his apostles. So the question is, to what extent has Romney in the past, and is he today, taking orders from the prophet in Salt Lake City? The prophet and the apostles, and clearly this would be a grave breach of the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. He has never addressed this issue. In the speech he gave on his faith, he did not go so far as Kennedy did to say that he would resign if there was a conflict. So I think this is a serious First Amendment issue. So far, unfortunately, Mormonism in its practices are secretive, basically. I've been in Catholic, Protestant, Muslim, Orthodox services, Hindu, Shinto, whatever. But my understanding is the Mormon faith will not let you into their services unless you're a Mormon. So we really do not know, is Romney still taking orders from the Mormon prophet and the apostles? And we need a definitive explanation and answer on that to satisfy the First Amendment, because I've traveled all over the world, and the United States is not perfect, but I think the First Amendment has done a great job in this country in preserving religious pluralism and freedom for all, including non-believers. And if we have someone in there taking orders from the Mormon Pope and his College of Cardinals, we're all in very deep trouble, because John Locke, who formulated the philosophy behind the First Amendment, makes it quite clear in his essay on toleration why we have to have something like the First Amendment, why we have to have something like separation of church and state. I think these are very serious issues. So far, the mainstream news media has given Romney a pass on them because, as we all know, the mainstream corporate news media is part of big business, and big business has mobilized behind Romney, the big businessman and corporate raider. So I'm trying to encourage the mainstream news media to try to nail Romney down on these issues and get him to address them before we could see him as president taking orders from the Mormon prophet and the apostles from Salt Lake Vatican City.
So this question of taking orders from the Pope, in this case the Catholic Pope, of course came up before President Kennedy ran for presidency, and he made a famous speech reiterating his belief in the First Amendment and the wall between church and state. And in that regard, Romney has not been at all clear. You would have thought that Jack Kennedy would give Romney a cue because of anti-Catholic bigotry at the time, suggested that Kennedy was going to take orders from the Pope. But instead, Romney has actually gone along with the kind of Christian rights narrative that there's a hostility towards religion in this country and that growing secularism is a danger, which, of course, is a total misreading of the First Amendment. What's your reaction?
I think you are correct. If you read the Romney speech and the Kennedy speech, it's very clear. But I will make the distinction here. Kennedy was a layman. He was not a cleric, let alone a bishop in the Catholic Church. In the Catholic Church, bishops have an obligation to obey the Pope, and so do archbishops and cardinals. They have, you know, special oaths that they take to obey. Romney is not just a ordinary Mormon. He's a bishop. He's an archbishop. We really don't know much more than that, but that is a matter of public record. You can read that in the recent article, The Real Romney, Vanity Fair, and they have a book coming out, which I just ordered. I don't have it yet.
So I suppose it's a reasonable assumption that to say that the Mormon Church is hierarchical, as is the Catholic Church. And that's not an unreasonable analogy, that if Romney is an archbishop in the Mormon Church, he is the Catholic equivalent would either be an archbishop or a cardinal reporting to the Pope. So how hierarchical is the Mormon Church? Because, you know,
Well, my understanding is they're just as hierarchical as the Catholic Church. And to put it another way, would any of us, even those of us who might be Catholic, vote for a Catholic bishop or a Catholic archbishop to become president of the United States of America? And I think the answer is clearly not, because of the reasons articulated by John Kennedy. There would be no separation of church and state. And I compare him, you know, to Newt Gingrich and Santorum. You know, Santorum's a pretty fundamentalist-type Catholic there, but he remains a layman. He does not have to take orders from the Pope. But Romney's a hierarch in the Mormon Church. And my understanding, they're hierarchical and disciplined and totalitarian, at least everything I've read about them.
And secretive, right? Because,
and highly secretive.
Because you cannot...
The other mainstream religions,
right.
I've been in all of their sanctuaries during services. You can go into all of them, see them in operation. You know, the Mormon Church sort of runs like Skull and Bones there at Yale that Bush was a member of. And Kerry was a member of, by the way, and someone asked Kerry about Skull and Bones, and he said, well, we're just not going to talk about that, and that was the end of the issue. Well, I think we need to talk about, certainly Skull and Bones doesn't raise a First Amendment issue, but the Mormon Church does raise a First Amendment issue. And, you know, I think that needs to be addressed, yeah. I teach, you know, constitutional law area. I was in at Harvard Law School with Romney. I followed his career for the last 40 years.
So you were a classmate of Romney's at Harvard?
Not only a classmate, we were in the same section together as one else at Harvard Law School, and we took all of our first-year classes together in the 1971-72 academic year, right.
And was there any discussion with you and your classmate Mitt Romney about the role of religion in politics and the First Amendment, separation of church and state?
That was not in first-year courses. That came later in constitutional law. And by then, Romney had gone off to Harvard Business School, and I had gone off to the government department to get a Ph.D. So we did not take con law together. Mm-hmm. But the leading con law expert at Harvard Law School at that time, Professor Paul Foyn, you know, who probably taught Romney, taught everyone there, taught Larry Tribe, taught me, you know, did teach us about the First Amendment, the philosophy of the First Amendment, and the importance of the First Amendment. Professor Foyn himself was Jewish, and, you know, Jewish people believe very strongly in the First Amendment, and I don't blame them.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Francis Boyle, who's a professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law, previously taught at Harvard University in West Point and was a member of the board of Amnesty International USA, and is the author of Tackling America's Toughest Questions. And we are certainly tackling a tough question here, which is, why has the influence of Mitt Romney's religion on him not been discussed by the mainstream media? And I mean, the one aspect of Romney's past is pretty extraordinary, I think, just in the context of how much the Republicans have vilified President Obama as a Muslim and with a fake birth certificate. And that still persists in the minds of many, many, probably, you know, at least half of the Republican voters, certainly most of the Republican voters in South Carolina. So contrast that with the fact that Romney's great-grandfather was a heretic from the Mormon Church because he was a polygamist, had five wives, moved to Mexico, and Romney's father was born in Mexico, and yet he ran for president of the United States. I thought, you know, that was the big charge against Obama, was he couldn't run for president of the United States because he was born in Kenya.
Yes, it is a matter of public record that George Romney, Will's father, back then he went by Will, was born in Mexico and therefore was constitutionally ineligible to run for the presidency of the United States of America. And yet there he was out there running, and no one really pointed this matter out. So I really don't know what to say. We know Romney here was born in the United States. I have no grounds to question Obama's production of that birth certificate, which I looked at. But this raises, and you know, back in those days at Harvard Law School, 1971, 40 years ago, Romney was just like his father. He was dealing with him in class, he was a very moderate, reasonable, sensible Republican. And he continued with that approach to politics until he was elected governor of Massachusetts. And then he immediately veered to the extreme right, highly opportunistic, to cater to the extreme fundamentalist right of the Republican Party to win the nomination. And, of course, also reverted to adhering to black letter Mormon doctrine on social issues, which we are seeing here today in this campaign. So, you know, it's a highly opportunistic approach that Romney has taken to politics. Indeed, I submit he had a life plan. He, even before he went to Harvard, he applied to the JD MBA program, Harvard Law School, Harvard Business School. The only people who go there are those who intend to make enormous sums of money. And then I think his plan was to make that money and use it to bankroll a run for public office. So we have to understand here, we're dealing with a very bright individual. I think he was cum laude at Harvard Law School, top 10%, top of his class at Harvard Business School. Very calculating, very methodical. I believe he had a life plan even, before he must have had this in mind when he applied for that JD MBA law program at Harvard, and he's pursuing it consistently.
Well, there's no question he's been pursuing the presidency for some time. He's been at it for, what, 5 or 6 years now?
Suggesting he obviously was bitten by his father's bug, because when he showed up at Harvard Law School in 1971, his dad had just lost to Tricky Dick Nixon. And putting aside the constitutional problem, certainly I think George Romney would have made a far superior president to Tricky Dick. I think, you know, he had some courage and integrity. As you know, he did stand up for civil rights, both within the Republican Party and also within the Mormon religion. And Will Mitt was very much like his father back in those days. He's the exact antithesis today, I regret to say.
Well, just in closing, you mentioned, what did you say, black letter Mormon doctrine?
On
social issues.
Abortion, against gays, against gay marriage, et cetera, et cetera. Look what the Mormons did to the Boy Scouts of America. When I was a kid growing up, the Boy Scouts of America were run out of New Jersey, and they were a pretty reasonable type operation. I was ultimately an Eagle Scout in the Boy Scouts of America. And then the Mormons took it over, moved it down to Texas, and turned the Boy Scouts of America into a pretty right-wing, reactionary, extremely patriotic, semi-militaristic, homophobic organization. Well, what the Mormons did to the Boy Scouts of America, I submit, if Romney becomes president, they're going to do the United States of America. And that's why I think the news media needs to smoke Romney out on these issues and nail him down.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Francis Boyle.
All right. Thank you very much, Ian, for having me on. Always happy to talk with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Francis Boyle. He's a professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law, previously taught at Harvard University in West Point, and was a member of the board of Amnesty International USA, and is the author of Tackling America's Toughest Questions. Let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back with historian Michael Kazin talking about the end of the Christian right. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Kazin, who's a professor of history at Georgetown University and author of American Dreamers, How the Left Changed the Nation, America Divided, The Civil War of the 1960s, Godly Hero, The Life of William Jennings Bryan, and The Populist Persuasion in American History. He also co-eds Dissent magazine and writes a column for The New Republic. His latest article at The New Republic is The End of the Christian Right. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Kazin.
Good to be here, Ian.
And I suppose to a lot of people that would be music to their ears from your... even though you didn't necessarily choose that title, The End of the Christian Right, from... your lips to God's ears.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Christian right's in trouble for various reasons that I talk about, write about in the article. They're obviously split right now about who to support against Romney, and that's pretty much going to ensure, I think, that Romney gets the nomination. Also, in a deeper sense, I think they're getting old. They have no leader to take the place of people like Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell and other figures who, whatever you think of them, were important figures in American life when they were in their heyday. And Also, there's been a lot of polls and good studies by sociologists, political scientists recently, which show that young people are less and less drawn to evangelical churches, especially more conservative ones. And the issue that's been most prominent in recent years that's been promoted by the Christian right, opposing gay marriage, opposing gay rights generally, is doing very badly. That is, gay rights is doing well. Gay marriage, of course, six states, pretty soon probably seven states, my own state of Maryland, for example. And the one issue where Christian right is still quite relevant, I think, is abortion. But even there, public opinion hasn't really changed very much about abortion. So, you know, I wanted to raise the point that even though the Christian right is still prominent and the media covers them exhaustively, especially in relation to the Republican campaign, in fact, they're in trouble. And I think and hope that they'll be in more trouble as the years go by.
Well, they appear to be in trouble in South Carolina, although they're fighting back. And there seems to be a sort of a rearguard action there by Newt Gingrich, who's been gotten a ton of money pouring in from Super PAC, from Sheldon Adelson and others. Of course, prior to this primary down there, the Christian right seemed to be quite concerned. There was a meeting at a Texas ranch involving Wildman and the Gary Bauer and a bunch of the luminaries of the religious right. But they're pretty much stuck with Santorum, who, ironically, of course, turns out he won Iowa, but he's not going to go anywhere. And they didn't do that well in 2008, neither. They didn't really unite around Huckabee until it was too late. Mm-hmm. And after all, it was Huckabee who made the famous quip about Romney, that he looks like the guy that fired you. So that doesn't speak well of their tactics. They can't seem to choose a candidate and get behind him, because clearly, had they done so, or at least not made a mistake with Perry, they'd be in much better shape against Romney.
No, I think that's right. I think that's right. And, you know, part of the problem, too, of course, is that even though most people who consider themselves Christian conservatives are very supportive of what they would call free market economics, you know, libertarian economics, pro-big business economics, you know, nevertheless, they would rather stress the so-called social issues. And those issues are not winners. They might be in South Carolina in a state election, but they're not winners nationally. And of course, the Tea Party, even though most people in the Tea Party are Christian conservatives, Tea Party people did not stress those issues in 2010. And so there really is not a unified Christian right in the way there was much more of one. Pat Robertson was riding high, and before that when Jerry Falwell was. And so, you know, when a movement crests and begins to decline, it's difficult to put it back together again. And also something else I didn't go into in the article, but it's worth mentioning. A lot of young evangelicals are no longer quite so interested in the older, you know, sort of body issues, you might say. They're interested in poverty. They're interested in being missionaries in Africa and do something about AIDS. You got people like Rick Warren, who, of course, was tried to be sort of nonpartisan between McCain and Obama in 2008. We'll probably do the same this year. He's not really a member of the Christian right, even though certainly he's an evangelical. And, you know, a lot of figures of his kind are trying to avoid being so partisan. So that's a problem, too.
Well, it's pretty clear, isn't it, Michael Kazin, that the millennial generation are kind of post-racial and post-sexual, and I'm sure that translates to millennial young Christians as well. In fact, I've met a number who are quite progressive. So it seems that time is against them, and there's a new generation emerging, and that they're simply relics in terms of their social dogma. But it's always been clear to me, at least, that the religious right and the evangelicals, particularly those on television, have always been a front for right-wing politics. Their theology has always been somewhat dubious.
Well, I disagree with you there. I mean, you know, I'm not a religious person myself, but I have respect for people who find their truths in religion. And I think, you know, when I wrote this book about William Jennings Bryan that you mentioned, biography of him, which was a empathetic book, though not necessarily a sympathetic one, I went to speak at various conservative Christian colleges. And, you know, I mean, these people have, they believe in their theology as much as I believe in my my secular liberalism, progressivism. So, you know, but I think that when you apply that to the political contest, when you apply that political competition, when you try to see that everything Obama does is wrong and everything Republicans are trying to do is right, then you've got a problem. And that's a problem they've fallen into, that they over-politicize certain issues. And and then when you have, you know, young evangelicals, as you were discussing, who say, no, we care more about poverty, we care more about AIDS, we care more about sort of the weak, you know, and the meek, as Jesus talked about in the Beatitudes, then they don't know quite what to say, and they end up looking angry and negative and censorious.
Well, you know, we could go through the history of those that have fallen from grace in terms of televangelists.
Yep.
There's a pretty rich history of that. And some of the current ones, like the Reverend Dollar and others, are pretty seem to be more interested in money than theology. But in that regard, Ralph Reed, who was the head of the Christian Coalition, if you ever read his memos that he wrote soliciting a job at Enron, where he wanted to be their lobbyist and what he would perform for them in terms of bringing in the religious right to help this criminal organization run by Ken Lay. And he did the same with Jack Abramoff, the famous lobbyist, or infamous lobbyist, I should say. He worked for him to con the Indians out of, casino owners out of money. It does make you wonder whether these people are more drunk with power than they are with...
Yeah, I mean, I think I was talking more about the rank and file.
Right.
People who really, I mean, think that America is going to hell, not to put too fine a point on it, and believe that only what they consider strong heterosexual families, going to church, praying, trying to get sinners redeemed, only that is the road to back to a moral nation again. And so, of course, they don't necessarily have leaders to follow anymore, but they are always looking for them. And as you say before, they're not going to find them this year. They don't like Romney. They'll accept him because they'll have nobody else. But you know, Gingrich, of course, it's, his marital problems coming back to haunt him with his second wife speaking out against him today, just as he seems to be gaining. So, you know, as you say, they are hamstrung by the fact that they have no candidate, and the candidates that they get behind, at least momentarily, have feet of clay.
Well, NPR did an interesting interview with a Gingrich supporter, a very devout Christian woman from Lubbock, Texas, who brought her family to volunteer for Gingrich in Iowa and through New Hampshire and is now working down in South Carolina. And she was attracted to him as a Christian because of his redemption. That,
yep.
You know, that he basically, in spite of the obvious hypocrisy of having an affair with the ex-wife, Marion, who's going on ABC tonight to talk about his call for an open marriage, he was married to her while he was having an affair with Callista, who he's now married to. At the same time, he was impeaching Bill Clinton for a minor sexual dalliance. But all is forgiven. That is a force not to be underestimated in evangelical theology, right? Redemption.
That's true. I think that's true, and it's you know, that's one of the redeeming factors about Christianity, of course, that whatever you do, you can be redeemed.
But, that could be surely that could be abused, right?
Yeah, but again, I mean, you've got someone like Santorum, of course, is a Catholic, not a Protestant, but and so is Gingrich, for that matter. So you've got a sort of ecumenism on the Christian right that is really new in American history. But in some ways, Santorum is sort of too good to be true. These people, I think he said recently that not only has he never had an affair with another woman, he's never actually sat on a couch next to another woman, not his wife. And that's just hard for anybody who's not from a fairly small circle around him to take seriously.
It does sound extraordinary. So what do you think is likely to happen then, Michael Kazin, down in South Carolina? They haven't been able to stop Romney. Their vote is split, and there's a last-ditch effort. Do you think there'll be any residual grudge against Romney, or are they obedient and will rally around the Mormon?
They have a real problem. I mean, as I mentioned in this piece in The Republic, with George W. Bush, you would see him, they had the president they wanted. He was born again. He clearly was quite willing to use evangelical language, talking about the war in Iraq as a crusade and so forth. And he had a very skillful speechwriter, Michael Gerson, who's now the who's now an op-ed columnist for the Washington Post, who wrote many of Bush's most really eloquent speeches, whether you agree with him or not, especially on the war in Iraq and on terrorism. But now, you know, I think Romney's likely to squeak through in South Carolina, and I can't imagine anybody else winning the nomination now. If anybody else surged to the front and began to get a lot of delegates, the so-called Republican establishment from Karl Rove down would try to stop them right away, because clearly in the polls, nobody else even comes close to Obama. So they've got a problem, and the Christian right could very well sit on their hands, not necessarily not voting for Romney in the fall, but not turning out the large numbers. And of course, remember, 2004, even though George W. Bush won the popular vote pretty easily, if he lost Ohio, he would have lost the election to Kerry. And one of the reasons he won Ohio was because there was a anti-gay marriage initiative on the ballot there, and people in the Christian right turned out very big numbers to support Bush, as well as, of course, to come out and vote on that initiative. And the election was fairly close in Ohio. And again, Kerry could have been a minority president if it wasn't for the Christian right. I don't see anything like that surge taking place this year.
Right. Kerry would have had a hell of a job governing with a $1.2 million deficit in the popular vote, which Bush had a $560,000 vote deficit in Florida. That didn't seem to bother him.
I think it would have been a tough road to hoe.
Michael Kazin, again, professor of history at Georgetown University and author of American Dreamers, How the Left Changed a Nation. Just to touch on your last book, American Dreamers, I'm quite puzzled by the rise of Ron Paul, who we haven't mentioned yet, and he is certainly a factor. He did well in all of the races so far and probably will come in third in South Carolina. One of the things I find extraordinary about this is that the young voters are flocking to Ron Paul, and so are anti-war Democrats, which leads me to ask you the question of what the hell is wrong with the Democratic Party? How could they lose the young voters from 2008 who swept in for Obama, and how could they lose the anti-war vote?
Well, I'm not so sure what you say there is right about young Democrats flocking to Paul. I mean, I don't see that in the polls. I mean, I think one of the things you do see is that young voters, you know, tend to be idealists. They tend to like people who talk about a completely different way to run the country. They tend to be, as young people, God bless them, less pragmatic, less, you know, saying, well, we can't do this, we can't do that. And Paul offers a completely different way of looking at government, looking at foreign policy. I mean, he, of course, doesn't want government to do anything abroad or at home. Except perhaps to protect the borders. And of course, it's for legalization of marijuana and so forth. So I think there's a way in which, you know, some young Democrats are supporting it, but more it's probably young independents, some whom were excited by Obama. But if you look at the polls by the breakdown by age group, young people are still the group that is much more pro-Obama than others. And, you know, we could argue about this probably for a long time, but I think Obama's going to be able to run in this year, saying he got troops out of Iraq, he's committed to scaling down the number of troops in Afghanistan. It's not certainly what I would have liked in Afghanistan, but I think he's going to be able to hold on to sort of, if you call it the anti-war vote, as opposed to Romney, who's been saying, you know, full scale ahead, we shouldn't move anybody out of Iraq.
And we should go to war against Iran.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Sir Michael Kazin.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Kazin, who's a professor of history at Georgetown University and author of American Dreamers, How the Left Changed a Nation, America Divided, the Civil War of the 1960s, and Godly Hero, the Life of William Jennings Bryan and the Populist Persuasion in American History. He also co-edits Dissent magazine and writes a column for The New Republic. His latest article at The New Republic is The End of the Christian Right. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again Sunday at 11 with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.